Hi everybody and welcome to the Wild Ginger Running live broadcast. Today I'm super excited to introduce you to a very important person who has been a massive influence on my life and my career in the hiking, running and outdoors world. So here today is Mrs. Wade, my former Duke of Edinburgh's Award teacher. Hey Mrs. Wade, how are you doing?
Hi there, yeah, please don't call me Mrs. Wade, you can call me Anne. I know it's really hard to call teachers by their first names, but you know, I think we've come a long way.
It has been about 20 years since I've been at school. Yeah. And I know, yeah. I have met you several times after school and you did say call me Anne, and it's a real struggle. So thank you for joining us today, Mrs. Anne Wade. Yes. How are you doing? Have you already been for a run today? What have you been up to?
Okay, I haven't yet been for a run today. I did 51 miles on Saturday. However, I did do 20 miles yesterday and about 15 miles on Monday.
Oh, wow.
So I'm just doing a short outing today, and I'll be back out tomorrow doing a longer one as well. So I run or walk every day.
Wow, that's brilliant. Brilliant. Okay, well, that's fantastic. You're putting us all to shame here.
But oh, I'm retired.
Yeah, you are retired, I was just going to say. So I'm very jealous. I can't wait. But this is fantastic. So my patrons, who are the loyal supporters of the channel, who get perks and win prizes, click here to sign up if anyone's interested. They're really excited about you coming on because you're my former teacher. I would say old teacher, but that could be misconstrued. I don't think you're old at all.
Well, thanks.
But former. Former teacher. We've got some really nice comments about you coming on. So first of all, Kat Elizabeth says, how awesome. Andrea says, fingers crossed I'll be able to watch live. This will be really fascinating. And Stephen is after some stories about me from school. So I'm just hoping you haven't remembered any of the really embarrassing ones.
Yeah. You want those now?
Oh, no.
I remember...
Oh, God.
there's a few things. I guess, you know, the Tour de Triggs is a big thing, obviously.
What, when I followed you?
That's the 50-mile hike in the depths of winter, going through Oxfordshire, Northamptonshire and Warwickshire. And you have to do it in teams of three. And what I remember particularly about that is that we had a teacher's team of me, Mr. Milton and Mr. McDermott, if you remember. And your team, it was you and...
Sunny and Dave was
Sunny
my
Dave,
team.
That's
yeah,
right,
and
yes.
Then there was Richard, Drew, and Pierre, but yes. Drew dropped out.
That's right. Yeah. So you were a team, and obviously on that event you have like staggered start times. So you started being young and vibrant. You started first or earlier on, and we started later. Inevitably, we did actually catch you up at one time. But the whole point about this event is that most of it is in the dark because it, you know, in December it gets dark at 4 o'clock and you're only starting at 11 or so. So you only effectively have 5 hours of daylight. And the big thing is the navigation, and you don't know the route until half an hour before, and you have to sit and plot it all on the map. And
back in the day. Really,
that's so stressful. That's the most stressful part of the event for me, plotting the route and getting it done in the time. And so you're navigating with your map and compass, old fashioned. And anyway, so you set off and then we set off, we caught you up, and I think you basically followed us then for the rest of the route, which was great. But the upshot of it was that we won the over 18 schools trophy and you won the under 18 schools trophy.
Yay!
So the organiser of the event actually came to school and did an assembly and presented us with our trophies at school, which was great because... you know, it was a big accolade for the school, and we did have teams going in for the Tour de Triggs, you know, right up until fairly recently. So that is really good. The association that we had with the event was really good. The other thing I remember about you was doing the Coast to Coast, Wainwright's Coast to Coast,
St. Lee's today,
and you were doing it for your silver. You were all very kind of young and naive.
Still am. Not young, still
naive. We backpacked it in 2 weeks, and there were lots of ups and downs and trials and tribulations, but yeah, it was good fun. And then, of course, your trip to Bolivia in 2000, which was, I think that must have been your gold, I guess.
Yeah, we did our gold expedition partly on there and partly in probably Wales or somewhere.
Yeah, well, you'd have done a practice. Yeah. And that was your assessment. And so you did that with on our expedition to Bolivia. So that's kind of mostly the things I remember, to be honest.
Yeah.
Just
you
the
not...
outdoory things. I don't...
No, you didn't actually teach me biology.
In the classroom.
No,
that's right. I just did you the outdoor education stuff.
Yeah.
And so, brilliant.
You were a biology teacher, but you also took on more and more of the D of E type responsibilities, didn't
that's
you?
That's right.
Towards as you got involved more and more in the school.
Yes. So I taught biology and outdoor education, and then in the end, I did, 90% outdoor education. And so I did lots of stuff with the younger kids as well as the older ones, and lots of expeditions, lots of. I did a trip expedition abroad every year, and summer backpacking challenges every year, and I did about 26 expedition trips every year, so that's quite a lot really, as well as all my own stuff, because obviously I do all this stuff anyway for myself, so you're just living in a tent or a camper van the whole time.
All the time, yeah.
Spent more tonight sleeping in that than in my own bed. And I certainly drove school minibuses way more than I ever did a car.
Yeah, you're always dragging around a load of teenagers in tow.
Yes, yeah. It was a way of life, not a job. It just consumed me totally.
Yeah, well, I want to say a big thank you.
And it's a nice time, so I don't have to do anything with kids anymore. Well, apart from my grandchildren, because I've got grandchildren now, so I do lots of stuff with them. I was camping last week in the Cotswolds with grandchildren, so I'm still doing it, but they're my own family rather than other people's.
A little bit nicer and hopefully less smelly and moody. But I do want to say a big thank you, because obviously you've been a massive influence on my life, and I kind of put you and Mr. Milton and all those other mad teachers, the non-sports teachers, but that just used to do the challenge walk, like Dr. Lockyer, Mr. Holland, Mr. Howard, lots of mad teachers. I just remember Dr. Lockyer going on about skylarks a lot. That was funny. You've been really important in my life.
Thank you.
You were quite enthusiastic about the school's annual challenge walk, weren't you? It was that one that was either 35 miles in a day or 50 miles over 2 days. I'm sure I did a challenge walk with you at one point.
I'm sure you did, because I did all of them. And then when Dr. Lockyer left and I sort of was doing all the challenge walks myself, I actually used to do kind of 3 a year.
Oh, wow.
So I do a kind of an autumn, winter and spring one. And they were all kind of 20, 25 mile type challenges. And some of them were kind of standard things like the Arden Way, or I would just make them up.
This way. We're going that way. If you go ahead of me, you've gone the wrong way, come back.
I'd obviously plan the route and everything in advance and do maps and all that, but we did loads, like the Three Peaks up in Yorkshire, South Wales Three Peaks. I did one called the Wenlock Winter Wonderland.
Oh, brilliant.
Just all around Wenlock Edge and loads.
Yeah, so. Oh, that's fantastic. I just remember the first one that we did was, we were in year 8, so we were 12, me, Richard, Jane and Sally, and we did the 50 miles over 2 days. I think that was before you were at the school, and all the year 10s.
That was across Wales. I did that one.
Yeah, but just not that Wales. First year. Yeah. Oh, and Dr. and Mr. Street as well. They used to do the bacon butties in the van. And Mr. Skirmer used to come as well. 50 miles over 2 days. And I remember all the year 10s and 11s thought that we wouldn't be able to do it because we were only 12 and they were like, 16, 17. And then we did it. And it was just one of the best achievements of my life, I think. And then you came on board with that. And then we did the Tour de Triggs, which was 50 miles. So you were sort of doing ultras before ultras was even a big thing. running, which we'll kind of talk about in a bit. And I just remember the amazing Wainwright's Coast to Coast. We were camping and hiking, so we had huge backpacks on. And I just remember, don't you remember at Grisdale Tarn, me and Alex's tent flooded?
Yes, I do. And you came to my tent and you said, "Help! Can I come in with you?" And I said no, because I already had my daughter with me and she was only 12. And I just said, "No, you'll just have to get in with somebody else, sorry."
Yeah, so then I had to go with Richard and Dave, smelly boys. I hope they don't listen to this. I do know my, all of. I still keep in touch with Richard and Alex and Dave and Phil. Pierre. I don't know where he is now. But yeah, we've still kept in touch. It's a good bond, isn't it? Going to the, into the outdoors.
Yes, it is. Yes, I remember you at Shap. We'd had fish and chips in the cafe there, and we went to the campsite, and yes, and you and Richard got into a survival bag together.
Oh God.
And I'm not quite sure what you were doing, but you were having quite a nice time.
We're both married to different people now, so
yeah,
I'll maybe delete that bit. there was a survival bag incident, I'm sure. I can't remember it now. I really hope he doesn't
listen to this. There's nothing untoward.
No, we were only little. But anyway, I remember the assembly when they announced that you had walked 100 miles all in one go, and my mind was just blown. I just couldn't even compute how people could walk that far. It was just like a driving distance, isn't it? So you were doing ultras before ultras was a big thing. I know there's tons of 100 milers now, and you're organising one at the moment, the Elephant, Bear and Bull 100 from Birmingham. So we'll talk about that in a bit too. It's great to have you on the show, because like to wind it right back and ask you how you got into running in your formative years. I'm not sure that I ever asked you this question.
No, you probably didn't. Yeah. I would say that I've walked and camped all my life. You know, yeah. I've always been an outdoorsy person, and I grew up, walking and camping with my family, obviously, throughout my entire life. And then as a teacher, and then, well, you kind of, as you go through life and you get married and you have a full-time job and you have children, you don't really have a lot of time to do much. But we've always had a dog, so I've always had to walk the dog. So that's always been the case. But then I think it was, I'm trying to think, 1993 was when I really sort of got into the long distance walking, and I did my first Tour de Trigs in the winter of 1993, and I did my first LDW 800, which was the Dartmoor 100, in 1994.
Oh, right.
So that was the first 100, and that I was the tender age of 34 at that time. So. And it was quite unusual, because LDWA, you know, it has a bit of a reputation as being an old person's association, and it is to a certain extent, but there are an awful lot more younger people involved with it now. But certainly at the time, you know, as a 34-year-old doing 100, I was kind of one of the youngest taking part, but I successfully completed that.
Yeah, during the 90s, it was like the time
of 41 hours or something. But I did it. Yeah, so I've kind of done hundreds sporadically since then, and I've actually done 18 in total now.
So I
was basically a long distance walker, I would say.
Yeah.
And then came foot and mouth in 2001, and access to the countryside was closed, and so I thought, what can you do? What can I do if I can't go into the countryside? I definitely don't. I'm not a gym bunny or anything like that. I don't do any exercise indoors. It's just not for me. I can't stand it. So I have to be outside. And I have to be in the countryside, on footpaths and bridleways and everywhere else. So thought, well, what can I do? So I took up orienteering big time. In 2001, because orienteering we could still do in the city parks, along canals, you know, there were sort of pockets of places, local woods, where you can still orienteer. So I joined Octavian Drubas,
the Coventry Orienteering Club.
Right, yeah. And I really got into orienteering. And of course, orienteering involves cunning running.
Yeah.
So I had to run, because, if to get around all the controls in the sort of time available and all that, you have to sort of run it. So I, I kind of started running, in effect. I mean, I used to do cross country running at school, and I always had to do the 1500 meters because nobody else would.
That's same as me. Yeah, you're like the same person.
That sort of thing. So I have done cross country running and all that, you know, prior to that. But anyway, I think, my kind of running took off then. So I thought, well, if I'm running around parks and woods and all that, when the countryside opened up again after Foot and Mouth, I thought, well, I'll try running some of the LDWA events.
Yeah.
So I did, and I kind of started, you know, I was kind of quite pleased if I could run or jog half of it and then walk the rest or whatever. And I just gradually built up to sort of marathon distance, because obviously, you know, the name implies Long Distance Walkers Association. It's all long distances, which are mainly marathons, plus ultras and stuff. And I kind of got to the point where I could actually run a full marathon. Well, they're obviously all trail marathons because that's what they are. And it really took off. So I was kind of in my early 40s, I suppose, when I started actually running. Yeah. And at that time, so it was early 2000s, at that time there weren't many females doing these things, and, you know, certainly not older people, because obviously even over 40 you're classed as a veteran, which is quite scary really, especially as I was only just starting. But I started doing pretty well, really, and actually winning quite a lot of races, I did start doing some races as well as the LDWA events.
Cool.
So I won, I don't want to kind of blow my own trumpet or anything.
Oh, but, no, do. We love this. It's very inspiring.
I won the High Peak 40.
Wow.
In 7 hours and 25 minutes. I got the record for a Coventry Way, 40 miles.
Do you still hold that?
Yeah, no, I don't. No, I did it in 6 hours 50. No, somebody else has beaten me on that now. And then Round Rotherham, which is 50 miles. I did that in 8 hours 25 and won that.
Wow.
And I kind of won the Trail Running Championship a couple of years running.
Oh, fantastic. I didn't know any of this. This is amazing.
But it's only because I'm female and old, basically.
And there was no one else there.
I mean, you were saying you went for the Manx Mountain Marathon over the weekend. I mean, the first time we did that, I was actually third placed veteran female.
Brilliant.
And I got a little cup and stuff. I do have quite a good trophy cabinet of all the stuff. So it kind of, between the ages of the kind of 40 and 50, I would say, I was doing really, really well. Also on multi-day events abroad, we did the Marathon des Sables in 2006. Which was the first one, and that was before it became London Marathon in the Desert, and ridiculously expensive and all that. We did it when it was few people and not too expensive. And we kind of did a multi-day event abroad every year after that. So we did one called the La Transac in France, and that was we did that for 3 years, and actually in 2010, when I was 50, actually on my 50th birthday, I crossed the finishing line on that one, and I was first female.
Amazing!
So I actually won it, if you like. I won the women's.
That's amazing.
Right. So yes, and that was quite an accolade, really.
Yeah.
I've never done as well on anything since then. That was my kind of.
That was the peak. Yeah. The highlight of your running career.
At the age of 50, it's kind of gone a bit downhill, you know, with the menopause and all that. You know, unfortunately, the menopause does affect you quite a lot. It slows you down.
Can't wait for that.
So it's a bit rubbish, really, but you just have to accept it, I guess.
Yeah, but then 50, you know, you've got a long time till the next age category, haven't you? It's quite a long period till that next age category. So now you're in your early 60s, you must be cleaning up again.
Probably not. I'm just kind of maintaining, you know, I used to do an average of 10K an hour, I would say, on all the multi-days. I mean, that's carrying all your stuff, you know, as well. It's not... not just running free, and then it's kind of gone down and down and down, and now I probably average something between 6 and 8k an hour, which isn't brilliant, and it's really, overall it's probably like a fast walking pace, but I walk a bit and jog a bit, and you know, just keep going really. That thing, that's the important thing, and try not to get injured. I mean, I've been really, really lucky not to have any major injuries. You get aches and pains, but then if you're going to do stupid things like, you know, try and run 50 miles, then obviously you get aches and pains. But the more you do it, you recover. The first 50 mile I did, I could hardly walk for a week. But now I did on Saturday and I was out again on Monday, no trouble at all, you know. So that's it. So that's a kind of potted history, really.
Potted history. Wow, yeah. I didn't know you were so decorated. I'll have to come and have a look at the trophy cabinet.
it's quite interesting, really. But I used to do well, but not anymore. I don't do any races now. I just do LDWA events because they're very relaxing. You, at the start, you have your cup of tea, you put your cup of tea down and you sort of amble out of the door of the pool, and then you have, and they're basically a walking or running buffet.
You just
enjoy it, and you have I just want a nice day out. So the 51 miler that I did on Saturday was in the Yorkshire Wolds, and it took me 13 hours, but hey, so what? I had a really nice time, and I managed to do it. I didn't actually need my head torch, which was amazing. As it was getting dark.
That
was quite a big achievement. I was quite keen to finish before it got dark. So, you know, you have your agenda changes as you get older.
Yeah, well, I don't think that I'm any faster than you aged 40, so I think you're doing amazingly still. So you've talked about your first one, that was the one, the Dartmoor one from the school assembly, You've done about 18 now, and you're about to do the Elephant, Bear and Bull, the Marshalls event, that's this weekend, isn't it?
So
tell us a bit more about the event, because I was really excited when I found out about this, because it's like the only LWDA event that is so long around the Midlands. Is it the first 100 around the West Midlands?
It is. The beauty of the LDWA hundreds is that they're in a different part of the country every year.
Yeah.
So you can never get bored of them, you know, because lots of events, they're 100-mile events, but they're just the same every year.
Every time, yeah.
So the beauty of these ones, they're somewhere different every year, and which is lovely because it means you can do it as part of a holiday, and lots of people sort of hire cottages and things and they spend the whole week in the area, and you really get to know a part of the country ever so well.
So
the one this year, it's the first time it's been in the West Midlands, and I'm very much involved because I'm route organizer. What I didn't say before is that I used to do very well in events, mainly because I can navigate. And you know, you'd see kind of other runners going off in all different directions, like starting stags. there weren't any GPSs at the time, so you have to use map and compass and so on. And so I used to do pretty well simply because I could navigate, hence on the Tour de Trigs and so on. But we actually won that outright a few times as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I remember thinking on that race, I was like, if I don't stick with Mrs. Wade, I'm not going to finish this because I cannot navigate quickly enough and well enough. So I just was like, Sunny, eat this bread. Yeah. And I was like, come on, Dave and Sunny, we've got to stick with Mrs. Wade. We can't have a rest here. We won't finish. So you were the reason, and you were the navigation. And I hold my hands up completely. That trophy was not ours to win. That was yours. That under 17's trophy was also yours.
So to get back to Elephant, Bear and Bull 100, as route organiser, I've basically done the route and written a narrative route description, and obviously done all the GPX files and everything else. And the reason it's called the Elephant, Bear and Bull is because elephant is Coventry, bear is Warwickshire, Bull is Birmingham, and our logo is in the shape of a pear, which is Worcestershire. So in case
I've got a pair.
Yeah, it's a pair. So it's looks like that's the logo.
Ah, cool. Oh, it's a pair.
So it's really so the pair is Worcestershire, as I said. Bear, Warwickshire, Elephant, Coventry and Bull, Birmingham. So it's it's very kind of historical route. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't have mountains or moorlands in the West Midlands. We do have plenty of mud.
And
it's been really, really bad of late.
Yeah, it sticks to the side of your foot, doesn't it? And it gives you a high heel platform.
Well, yeah. But worse than that, it's just been a swamp. You know, all the fields have been like paddy fields and you're just dodging around in the fields. But anyway, so yeah, we've got a lot of, you know, medieval history and all that. And we actually go, the route starts and finishes in Moseley, at Moseley Rugby Club. And then it goes out via the Wasley Hills, Licky Hills, and then then through sort of Alvechurch, Tanworth in Arden, Henley in Arden, Aston Cantlow, Stratford, Norton Lindsay, Warwick, Kenilworth, Coventry, Meriden, centre of England, where we go, Barston,
Slighol,
back to, you know, then back through Birmingham to Moseley. So it's obviously a huge wiggly circular route. You know, if anybody's interested, they can look at the website. The entries are still open. If you've got a 50 mile qualifier, you can still enter it.
You're making me want to do it. I know that I'm not capable of it right now, but
really
I just really want to do it.
It's a very varied route, obviously. I mean, and it's as much off road as possible. Mm-hmm. So there are quite a few hard surfaces. So there's a lot of cycleways, canal towpath. It's not all canals. Lots of people think it's all just going to be flat and canals, but it isn't.
Well, the Licky Hills is not flat.
No, exactly, and overall there's about 15 miles of canals, but it's broken up. It's not all, well, it's little bits of canals, so it's just footpaths, bridleways, tracks, cycleways, and all that all around the West Midlands. We've had some fun and games with HS2, all those sorts of things. So, and even today, we've got 10 days to go till the Marshalls event, and you know there's a couple of construction sites which have appeared, blocking a couple of paths. So it's just never ending, really, and you just find ways around it. And it's all fun. And
how easy is it to navigate? Will it be quite easy to navigate on the day, or will you have to sort of take the map and be like, or will it be a little bit waymarked?
No, the route is not waymarked at all. So you have to use my very, very accurate and detailed route description. and I've also, obviously there's a GPX file, so people will download that onto their GPSs, and lots of people will just use their GPSs to navigate around. I don't actually have a GPS. I'm kind of one of the few people. I'm still a map and compass girl.
Yeah, I have this big thing, but I don't know how to use the navigation function on it. I need to learn how to do that before I do an 100 miler. I've used this map and compass for the Isle of Man, and I went wrong a couple of times, but not because I can't map read, but because I didn't realise that I had to. I was like, I know the way, and then I was like, oh no, there are no stud marks here, I'm going the wrong way. So I had to get the map out and have a look and go back.
that happens. But GPSs have kind of revolutionised navigation, really. And I mean, even on the LDWA events, I would say at least half, if not three quarters of people, even the old blokes in boots, you know, they all have GPSs, and you see them walking around with them. But I'm just not a fan of them, because I like a bigger picture. And I like to study routes, and I'm a bit of a map geek. I love reading maps, and I can just read a map like a book.
So,
I can see in the background.
But, it's a map of my local area.
And I generally, for events that I do, I kind of look at the route description, I look at the maps, and I study them very, very carefully and make notes and all that. So It's just part and parcel of doing the event, really. I like to know where I am at all times and where I'm going. The problem with the GPS is that people have no idea where they are.
Yeah, it's like sat nav, isn't it?
You know, the hills, and if the batteries run out or something happens, they're completely lost. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I've even seen people going in the opposite direction because the GPS is telling them to go in the opposite direction.
Or they're following it the wrong way.
Yeah, they kind of go wrong and then they pick it up again incorrectly and start going back, and it's quite hilarious.
You could just point at them with your compass hand.
Yes, that's right. I was going that way.
So you've got the Marshalls event on Saturday.
Next Saturday, yes. I'm a bit nervous about it. The 29th, is that? Yes, the 29th of April.
Oh, okay.
I'll be setting off at 10 o'clock. Closing my club.
Yeah. I was just going to say, you've just done a 50-miler this weekend, just gone. And yes. Then I was thinking, oh, that's a bit soon. But yeah, so it's in 2 weekends' time. So what has your training looked like for this 100-miler?
Well, I never really train for anything as such. Because I'm doing it all the time. You know, I do at least a 20-miler every weekend. Mm-hmm. And obviously sometimes ultras, you know, instead of a 20-miler, I do, but as I say, it's at least a 20-miler every weekend. And then I do, you know, in the week, I'm kind of doing between 10 and 15 pretty much every day.
Miles.
Or sometimes I just do if I haven't got much time, I'll just do 5 miles. I don't have a program or a plan or anything like that. I just keep going and doing stuff. I mean, it's like the 50-miler on Saturday. I just wanted to do it because it was in the Yorkshire Wolds and I don't know that area of the country very well. And I'd never done that event before.
Yeah.
And people saying, well, why are you doing that like 2 weeks before the 100? And I'm like, well, nothing that we do is very sensible.
It just looks nice.
So it doesn't really matter. And because I'm kind of experienced and used to doing it, then I recover very quickly and it'll be fine, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm not racing, you know, I'm not running badly or anything like that. I'm walking a lot, I'm jogging. So I'm not kind of taking it out of my body as much as I would be as if I was running flat out or racing madly.
And so the training and the running in the events, is the training, your training run like that's 20 miles, is it a combination of running and hiking, or do you try to run all of your training? Well, the not training.
Well, I generally walk up hills because I like hilly routes because hilly routes are a rest.
Yeah.
Because you get a rest walking up the hill and then you can just kind of, you know, go jog along the flat and then you can run down and that's a rest as well. So hilly routes are actually really, really good. I find flat, continuous running much harder than anything else. And obviously in the latter stages of something like the 100, I use poles. I would always advocate using poles massively, and I march with poles because I can keep up a much faster pace marching with poles than I can trying to shuffle along all bent over. And I don't think it's very good for me shuffling along all bent over. I think it's much better for your body and your posture and everything else. Because the thing about poles is that they keep you upright.
Yeah, open your lungs up.
And open up your chest. And you can also get a much bigger range of movement with your hips and your legs. So you can take much bigger strides. And you're not all kind of closed in and shuffling along and getting hamstring damage from your legs being bent all the time. So I think, you know, marching fast with poles is actually much better for you than trying to jog all the time. And to be honest, I think I can actually go faster marching with poles than I can shuffling along trying to run. It's silly.
Yeah. And also downhill, like, does it help you with the knees a little bit and the joints?
I would say poles are, so apart from the kind of pole marching fast and good for your posture and good for your range of movement, especially when you get to my age and stuff like that, you want to keep your range of movement as much as possible. Apart from that, I would say they obviously help going up because you can press into the ground and, you know, use your arms to pull yourself up. They're absolutely brilliant for going down as well, particularly if it's a technical downhill, because you can kind of lean on them and it saves a lot of, I read somewhere it's like 80% of your weight or something like that, you know, so you're not putting as much pressure on your joints. And one of the main things is balance. Mm-hmm. If you get going across streams, doing river crossings or anything like that, or even just a big muddy patch, they stop you sliding around. And so they're really, really good for balance. And, you know, that's one of the things, you know, that's quite important for me. And you can just kind of sail through a huge muddy patch rather than skating across. And that kind of uses up extra energy in your legs as well.
Yeah. Saves you a lot of energy from stabilizing yourself all the time, doesn't it? Yeah. Are you still using the pole, my dead pole from the race that we did together? I saw on the picture on the thumbnail, you've got odd poles, haven't you? You've got my old pole. Yes. Did you break a pole and I broke a pole? And I was like, here, you just have my pole because continuing on days like that I wasn't.
I broke a pole trapping it in between a couple of rocks. And then I think you also broke one, and anyway, you gave me your pole, which I was very grateful for, and I'm still using it, so I do have odd poles, but it doesn't matter because a pole is a pole is a pole.
And it's a really lightweight one as well. It's a really good one.
Very lightweight. If I'm backpacking, as in carrying a backpack with my tent and everything else in it, then I do have some heavier weight poles that I use. But for all these events and things, I just use my lightweight ones, and I wouldn't be without them at all.
The one that I gave to you, that's a Mountain King one. Was your other one, was that a Mountain King as well? Because they do the lightest ever poles.
Trailblaze.
Mountain King Trailblaze.
One of those. I don't know, but I also use them even on some of my middle of the week runs, because I like the extra arm workout. As a runner walker, I don't do much with my arms. My husband's always telling me I'll get noodle arms, so I use poles to give me extra arm workout as well. So it's good for me, to use them.
Keeps you out of mischief. What about the map reading? Like, how do you juggle the map when holding the poles? Because I've found that a bit tricky in the past.
It depends what I'm doing. I mean, something like if I'm doing a long event like the 100, I always recce it first.
Okay.
I'll talk about that maybe in a bit. But I kind of tuck the map down into my waist belt, and I look at it and think, right, okay, I'm going three fields, hedge on left, off you go, and I just march along and then look at it again as and when.
Memorise a part of it, memorise it as much as you can, and then look again. Memory.
I've got quite a good map memory. So I do remember, and I can look at the map and look at the shape of the route that I've plotted on, and then just do the shape of the route, and if I know I'm following a footpath for, I don't know, a couple of kilometres or whatever it is, and there are no other footpath junctions or something, I just look for the way markers, footpath way markers or whatever, you get used to it, and you get good at, you know what to expect, really.
When you
look at a map and you can see whether you're going uphill, downhill, what side of the hedge you should be, all those things.
You just get practiced at it.
That's it. Sometimes it does get a bit of a juggle, especially if I'm trying to eat as well.
You sort of need like a little cup on the end of the pole. I'm just having a bit of bother at the moment because I want to do my next event with poles. I'm just trying to work out how to put my GoPro on the pole so that I'm not like constantly having to like put two poles in one hand and then put a selfie stick with a GoPro here, because I've done that before on training and it's just really, really faffy and takes a lot of energy. So I'm trying to work out how to get my GoPro to just sit on the top of the pole. Nobody's made an attachment for that. It just seems barmy.
So niche market.
Very niche market. Just one person at the moment, it seems like. There's some YouTube videos. I'm checking it out with one of my patrons. She does 3D printing and designing, so she might make me like a little gadget or something. So that's quite exciting.
I mean, the poles are most, you know, most useful when you know your route.
Yeah.
On a route that you don't
or
know.
Or waymarked one.
It is a bit annoying, but if you've learned your route or you know your route anyway, then you know you don't have to worry about it. You can just march along.
Yeah. Or if it's a waymarked one, like one of these kind of newfangled 100 miler events that we do these days, they're sometimes waymarked, aren't they? So that could be. And so we've talked about your training in terms of like what you put your body through week after week, but to do 100 miles it just seems to me, the more I look into it, the more there is apart from getting your body in the right condition. So you've got to look at the, well, on races you've got to look at things like the cutoffs and will you meet those, and then you've got gear, fuel, we've mentioned navigation, you've also mentioned wrecking. Really is a real, like, a bit of a cottage industry, isn't it, doing one of these 100 milers. You've really got to get your head inside
Well, that's it. And I would say, I mean, it's probably 90% of it is mental anyway. You know, you've just got to have the grit. You know, after 30 miles, the pain doesn't get any worse. It just carries on.
Yeah.
So I would say that the main thing for preparation is time on your feet. You need to do a lot of mileage over months, I would say, rather than weeks.
But low intensity.
Yes, very low intensity, time on your feet. You know, like I said, I spend a lot of time on my feet anyway, so I don't have to do any special training. But you do have to condition your legs and your feet for that time on your feet, so that you don't get injured and you don't get foot problems and stuff like that. So time on the feet is really, really important. What else have I got on my list? Soft feet, yes. Lots of people think they have to kind of bathe their feet in surgical spirit and get them all hard. Well, that's absolute rubbish. I would not condone that at all, because basically the blisters just form under the hard skin and you can't get through it to pop them, and it's just an absolute nightmare. Mm-hmm. So I would keep your feet as soft as possible. So, you know, put body lotion on your feet and rub it in your feet every day or after you've had your shower, and keep your feet soft. Mm-hmm. Because then you will be less likely to have foot problems, and, you know, keep your nails short and things like that. I mean, my nails are disgusting. You know, I've got real runner's nails. I mean, but as a result of lots of mistakes, like having shoes that are too small, shoes that are too tight, and all those sorts of things. And you know, having sort of blisters under the toenails in the past, and, you know, losing toenails and all those sorts of things. But you know, you do learn over the years, and I don't get any blisters now at all. I get no foot problems at all. But
amazing.
So I'll tell you how to prepare your feet before the event in a minute. But so the preparation, time on the feet, keep your feet nice and soft and as much as possible. Wrecking a route makes more difference than you could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
For a start, you learn the route. And I do anyway, and I study the map and the route description intently, and I make lots of notes, because I do the recce over 5 days, something like that.
Okay.
And each evening after, and I do it, and I do it as a holiday, so obviously I'm not recceing this one because I know it like the back of my hand, but it's like last year it was up in it was a Transpair 900.
Okay.
And you know, I actually went up there with Vaughan, and we had a holiday, so it's a really nice reason to have a holiday. So you do the route over sort of 5 days or whatever. At the end of each day I make notes on the route, and you know what to look out for and stuff like that, and I essentially learn the route. Uh-huh. So that on the day I don't have to even look at a map or the route description or anything. I can just march with my poles and get round. So learning the route's really, really important. Mm. Secondly, you see all the bits that are going to be in the dark, you see them in daylight, so you don't miss out on any of the nice scenery, because generally, I mean, I don't know, I wouldn't call the West Midlands beautiful, but most of the hundreds are generally in beautiful parts of the country, and you get wonderful views and all that, and you want to see those views, so, you know, see them in daylight. You get the opportunity to read all the information boards and explore some of, you know, visit the mines or sites of historical interest or whatever. So you know, you can do it as part of a holiday, and you learn about the area, you're contributing to the local economy. It's a really good way of doing it.
Yeah, definitely.
Running, yeah, and it just yeah, obviously it means you can march with your poles because you're not having to faff with a map or route description. It gives you confidence. You know the route, you know you can do it, and you've got that route in your head. Yeah. And you're not going to be dithering with any of the navigation. You're not going to stand there during the second day at 80 miles thinking, where do I go now? Because you just can't think and you're too tired and all that. So you want to be able to just do it without really having to think. And so you don't dither. You've got confidence that you know the route. And also, I think it's really important, kind of like the night before or the several nights before the 100 event, I go through the route in my mind. So mentally, I've done it. I think that's a really good thing to do. So you kind of go through each section of the route and you go through it in your mind and you've learned it and you know where you're going, and that gives you confidence that you are going to complete it. So I think that's really a good tip.
Do you take photos of the route when you're doing your recce so that you can sort of refer back to them all?
I take photos just because I'm on holiday.
Yeah. Not because you're like, must remember this left-hand turn.
Yeah, I mean, when you're actually on the event, you don't care two hoots about really where you're going or where you are or what you're seeing. You just want to get the event done. You just want to do it. And you don't want to have to think, oh, gosh, that's a really nice building over there. You don't care. When you're 80 miles in, you're just like, I don't care. I'm just
striding with my poles.
Yeah, exactly. So you do get into a kind of a bit of a trance like zombie mode, and you're just going for it. So that's kind of all the preparation, really.
Yeah.
And obviously you've got to be used to eating and drinking as you're going along and eating proper food. Do not even attempt to have gels or any of those awful things, because you will just be sick. There's a limit to how many of those you can have, and the people that I've known that have tried to have them just can't cope with it.
What do you eat? Seen lots of...
So I just eat normal food.
Yeah.
And because I do LDWA 100s, like I said, it's like a walking, running buffet. You have proper food at every checkpoint, and so kind of during the event, you don't think of the 100 miles as one big thing. You can't. It's mind blowing. So you have to do it in bite sized chunks, and you just go from checkpoint to checkpoint. So even from the start, it's 6.2 miles to checkpoint one.
Uh-huh.
And then when you get to checkpoint one, it's 7.5 miles to the next one. So you do it in bite-sized chunks.
Yeah.
And at each checkpoint, you have to eat and drink. You've got to eat early. Lots of people think, 6 miles, I don't need to eat anything, I'll be fine. But you need to get your stomach used to having food in it
right at
the beginning. I just have a policy of eating pretty much as I can at each checkpoint. But there's also the kind of the balance of, you don't want to be in the checkpoint for too long.
Yeah.
I once did, I can't remember which 100 it was, but I did a bit of a survey thing, and I calculated the time I arrived at the checkpoints and the time I left each checkpoint, and I actually worked out that I'd been sitting down for 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
But then you sort of think, well, if I hadn't been sitting down for 4 hours, I probably wouldn't have been able to complete it. But you do need to be mindful of the time that you're sitting at checkpoints, because you can sit there, particularly in the latter stages, and you just tend to sit there and stare into space. And, 20 minutes can have gone by very easily. So you do have to be a bit careful. So I have a policy of not really sit. I don't sit down until the kind of... at a 25 mile stage, really, and then I'll sit down and have a cup of tea and a meal and whatever else. But the earlier checkpoints, I'll just kind of go in, grab as much as I can hold in my hands, or I have a front pouch, which you can see on the photograph, and I have a bag in there, so I can kind of throw food in, like bits of cake and sandwiches, and I just eat proper food. And as I go along, and you often get to the point where you can't eat anything sweet anymore, or conversely, some people can't eat savoury things anymore. Everybody's different. So, you know, for me, I get to the point where I can't eat anything sweet. It just makes me want to retch. So I then have to just eat cheese and savoury things.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get to the checkpoints and there's a whole array of food and you're like, well, what can I actually eat? That's why I have a policy of eating as much as I can when I can, same as I will run as much as I can when I can.
Yeah.
And then walk when I can't, and then, you know, just eat what I can, you know.
Yeah.
A bit later on, because your body kind of does funny things to you as you go along. So you just have to kind of play it by ear a bit and not be rigid about it and just do what you can when you can. So going from checkpoint to checkpoint, eating and drinking, yeah, keep yourself hydrated. If you get dehydrated, you won't be in a very good state. I've talked about poles a lot.
Chafing, we like poles.
chafing is a massive thing.
Yeah.
And you know, I chafe really badly under my bra strap at the front.
Oh, do you? So I've never had it chafe there.
Yeah, I chafe there quite a lot, and I use Sudocrem. So I just plaster myself in Sudocrem. It's a great thing. I discovered it obviously when I had my first child as nappy cream, and I've had a big pot of it ever since. And so I chafe, and on your back, you've got to be really careful that your rucksack doesn't swing on your back, particularly if you're running, because you will get really badly chafed on your back, and you get in the shower. It's like, ah, things like mad. So I just plaster my back in Sudocrem, and then your nether regions, they will get really sore, because obviously when you're going along and you have to pee and poo, mostly out in the bushes, and obviously the checkpoints do have toilets, but that's often when you don't need to go, you know, you need to get
when you need to go. Yeah, especially if you're running, you're like, I need to go now.
And you have to be really, really careful with the chafing. So, and because the trouble with peeing is that the more dehydrated you get, the more concentrated your urine gets. Mm-hmm. And for ladies, really concentrated urine burns, and it can be really, really sore.
Yeah.
So I just plaster those areas with Sudocrem again.
Yeah, before it even starts to happen?
Yes, right at the beginning, you know.
Okay.
And I also wear a sanitary towel. I mean, I wear a panty liner anyway when I go out running, because I always have to pee when I'm out. But on the longer ones, I wear a proper, you know, full size. Yes.
Really? to catch any drips, after you finish peeing, it's to like catch drips.
Yes, so to absorb any drips,
yeah.
And also helps to prevent chafing, because the drips aren't staying there.
Being absorbed
in your pants, and it keeps you drier. So with this combination of Sudocrem and... Pardon?
Have you ever tried period pants? I've just done a review of period pants, and it's like, instead of having a horrible plasticky sanitary towel, they're just pants with like a thicker sort of lining. They might be a bit warmer maybe, but it might just be a nicer experience.
Yeah. Well, I haven't tried them, but having said that, I would change the sanitary towel.
You wouldn't be able to change the pant as much.
And you'd only be wanting to change the whole lot. So,
yeah, that'd be
annoying. But, you know, I just use a combination of Sudocrem and sanitary towels, and that really helps.
Yeah.
And then obviously for pooing as well, just make sure you like wipe really well, and wet wipe and Sudocrem as well, because that can really chafe badly. Obviously you don't leave wet wipes in the countryside, you put them in a bag.
Yeah.
I carry a nappy bag or a dog poo bag.
And
just put stuff in there if I need to. But that's really important, because, you know, it builds up, you know, and if you start getting the trots or anything like that, it can get very, very sore. So that's something I would recommend. And then foot wise, in order to sort of prevent blisters and trench foot, because I mean, I've done hundreds where my feet have been just wet for 36 hours.
Yeah.
And you can get really bad trench foot if you're not careful. So
yeah.
Before the event, I plaster my feet in Sudocrem.
Okay.
And I have a an A4 size plastic bag, and I put loads of medicated talc in it. So I put my Sudocrem'd foot into the plastic bag, so it all gets covered in talc as well.
Okay.
So you've got a kind of waterproofing from the Sudocrem and the lubrication from the talc, with a nice new comfy pair of cushioned knee socks and my shoes, and that's it. I just don't get any foot problems.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's amazing.
So I would recommend that approach, and you could always redo that, you know, at the breakfast stop or at some other, you know, point down the line. I generally don't. I just go all the way through. But
yeah,
you could redo it. I have redone it before in the past, and that helps as well, particularly if it's been very, very wet.
Yeah. Would you ever take like have a drop bag with a change of socks and new shoes or anything like that?
On the LDW 800s, you can have a drop bag at the breakfast stop, and the breakfast stop is always at somewhere around 55, 60 miles, something
like
perfect.
That. So
And you can obviously put in there what you like. I've never done new shoes or anything, but I have done new socks, and obviously resued and helps my feet at the same time, and I, you know, you can have nice little goodies in there. I'm a big fan of chocolate milk. I think there was 100 I did, and I actually drank 11 bottles of chocolate milk.
Wow, is that 11 pints then?
milk's really, really good because it's a really good combination of carbohydrate and protein, and it settles your stomach. And all that, because stomach issues are quite a big thing. That's why I'm saying you've got to get your eating and drinking right to be successful. And you know, because if you start the slippery slope, if you start feeling nauseous and then you don't eat, you'll be even more nauseous, you'll have no energy, and it's the slippery slope to not completing it. So, and just being sick and feeling really bad. So you've got to get your eating and drinking right, and I find chocolate milk really, really helpful. And you know, that I think there was another 100 I did, the last 30 miles I just drank milk. and you know, and it was fine. And you know, talking about that, you will have low spots. The lows can be very, very low. I always have a really bad low spot, usually kind of in the early hours of the night, sort of around 2-3 in the morning. I think generally your body's a bit low then anyway, or you know, your body temperature is very low, and I always find it really difficult to kind of get through that. But I think the important thing to know is that it will end. And you just got to kind of try and manage it as best you can.
Just keep going. No point thinking about it.
You know, you can maybe sit in the checkpoint a little bit longer. You can even lie down for half an hour. And it doesn't matter, you know. So you can lie down and get yourself better, and then off you go again, and you're fine. And then as soon as the sun comes up, or as soon as the next morning comes, suddenly life is much rosier. And you know, on the Transpennine 100, I had a terrible first night. I was like going at about 2 miles an hour. It was terrible. But then as soon as it got light the morning, I had my breakfast. I ate full breakfast, you know, cereal and bacon and eggs.
Lovely.
Eggs and all sorts. You know, like an English breakfast, and I went off and my pace picked up massively, you know, and I was able to carry on faster than I was before. So, you know, you just got to know that the low patch will end. And then you'll be all right again. You know, don't give up just because you don't feel bad. You don't feel well, because you will be okay. It's just getting through it.
That's really good advice.
What else have I got? Having sort of supporters and things is quite nice. And we, on the LDW 100s, we have trackers, and I really like the trackers because it's very motivational, knowing that people are watching you, and you've got friends and family and people supporting you, and they're kind of willing you on. And I found that very motivational. And the other sort of motivation, if you do any fundraising or anything like that, that's also very motivational, because you actually have to do it.
So
if you're most people don't do it as a fundraiser, they just do it for fun. I have occasionally done fundraising in the past.
The picture on the thumbnail is of you wearing a purple tutu because you're raising money for Vaughan, your husband Vaughan's condition, myasthenia gravis, which is the muscle weakness and double vision, which sounds utterly rubbish, but that's for MyAware charity, is that
right? Yes, and it's all purple, so you know, I originally had a purple vest and I've got a cap with MyAware written on it, and I have my purple tutu. I mean, that's nothing. MyAware don't give me the purple tutu. That's actually my daughter's.
Yeah. Don't you mean your granddaughter's?
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, but hundreds do weird things to you. So it's like in that photograph, I'm wearing full waterproofs because the nighttime was awful. That was on the Hadrian 100, and we went across Crossfell, highest point on the Pennine Way, and it was really windy, really rainy, and it was just awful. But I just never took my waterproofs off because I think your body temperature does weird things. And even though it was sunny and warm on the next day, I was never warm enough to actually take them off.
You're like cold to the bone.
And you don't really think about it. You don't think, oh well, you know, I might be a bit hot, but you actually don't think that you could take them off because you're just not in that mind. You're just completely tunnel visioned towards the end and marching on. So I did look a bit weird with these waterproofs and a purple suit. It was tucked in for a while, but I kind of had this huge midriff.
Oh, it looks great.
So actually that photograph was taken by Vaughan near the end of the event, and I think I probably said to him, oh, just let me get the tutu out, you know.
Quick. Yeah. Bless him.
Anyway, there we are. I mean, Vaughan's done a few hundreds as well, but not as me. Yeah.
That's amazing, especially with that condition.
He did the 51-mile event on Saturday as well.
Wow.
We did it together. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is, really.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah, so motivate, you know, being motivated is quite important. And obviously you see people along the way and you can chat to people and...
Excuse me. Yeah.
And at the checkpoints, bless you, at the checkpoints, all the marshals and everything are always really friendly and encouraging and supportive. And, you know, generally, like on the LDWA hundreds, that you can't stay at a checkpoint for more than 2 hours. Otherwise you get retired. But you can stay there for as long as you like up to that point, provided you know you're going to meet the cutoffs for later checkpoints. But everybody wants you to do it, so we're all singing from the same hymn sheet.
Yeah They do sound like fantastic events. I'd really love to do one, especially with all this eating going on.
there's nothing wrong with that, and as a runner walker you can pretty much eat what you like, so you don't have to worry about it.
It's just a nice day out. Is it like a pub crawl but a little bit longer with less beer?
Well, so there are some checkpoints do have beer as well.
Oh, perfect. Sign me up. Well, I've got some quick fire questions for you to end with that are just silly bits and bobs. It's been a fantastic amount of advice there, and I think it's really good to hear it. And I just need to hear these things over and over again, especially the one where it doesn't always get worse. That kind of advice, there will be a low point. I really need to suck it up and just like keep going, pushing through. So yeah, you've very much inspired me now for my next race.
It's like childbirth, it will end.
Oh god. I would rather do an ultra any day. I'd rather do the worst. I'd rather do my Bob Graham round again, which was the hardest thing I've ever done. I'd rather do that than give birth again, because that was the most pain I've ever been in my entire life. Anyway, we don't want this to last another half hour.
See, all these things end, so
I know, but I didn't really choose labour. Like, if I could have made Steve do it, I would have. But you choose to do these ultras, don't you? It's a bit different.
There's a rosy glow about them, though, because you do one and you think, never again.
Yeah.
Like, you have a child, you think, never again. And then you get a rosy glow about you and you think, well, maybe. I reckon I could do it again.
No more children. But yes, more ultras, yes. Yeah, definitely. I just love the idea of how you live your life, which is like going and doing loads of hiking and running all the time. Like, I just can't wait to retire. Yes. It sounds brilliant.
I mean, I did it as a job as well. So I kind of had a dream job as well.
Well, I thought this would be the dream job, but actually there's a lot of sitting in front of the computer, so I just need to do it quicker and then get out the door. But anyway, we've got some quick fire questions. Flapjack or gels? I know the answer to this.
Flapjack, obviously.
Yeah. After a race, beer or wine?
Beer. Beer and a packet of crisps, perfect.
Oh, yes.
Rehydration and salt. Can't beat it.
And a bit of chocolate milk after.
Chocolate milk, yeah. Chocolate milk's for during.
Yeah. A Kindle or a real book?
I don't have a Kindle, so it'd have to be a real book. Yeah.
We're such dinosaurs, aren't we? I haven't got a Kindle either. Music on your run, like with headphones, or birdsong?
Birdsong. I don't have any headphones. And I would never advocate using them anyway because of the danger of being run over or just not seeing or hearing, well, not seeing or not hearing things. And yeah, I want to be immersed. I want to be immersed into nature and I want to have a conversation with my fellow participants.
Yeah, if there are any around. I was at the back of my last race. I've got these though. They hook over your ears like this and they don't go inside your ears. So you can hear everything and the music or the podcast.
Well, I've never seen those. I mean, I also have a problem because my ear canals are quite small and earbud things, they just fall out. I can't keep them
me
in
too.
Any. And if you're sweating, they fall out too.
That's why I've been doing this. Every time I smile, it squishes them out. So yeah, that's why these are so good.
Oh, I haven't seen, what are those pink things?
They're called bone phones. Well, I call them bone phones. They're bone conduction headphones. So they send the signal down straight to the cochlea, I think, rather than inside the hole first. So they put a vibration through. So they work vibrations. Try and remember to bring them to the event and you can have a go if you've got time. But yeah, they're really, really good. Mm. Yeah, I'll send you my review of them. I'll put a link to that review up here and in the podcast show notes as well if anybody else is interested in them. But it just means that they're the only headphones that you're actually allowed to use on some races because of the dangers, you know, of listening to marshals and safety instructions and traffic.
I appreciate that. And I mean, I've never really run with music, so I'm just not used to it.
Yeah, I don't run with music much. I run with podcasts, you know, like if you're getting a bit down or bored, then it just makes the time go quicker and it makes you smile. Yeah. Some comedy podcasts. Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea. I mean, I think on a 100, I could understand why it would be really good on the second day, especially.
Yeah, in that 1 o'clock in the morning.
My aim is always not to go into the second night.
Yeah.
That, you know, but I've done hundreds. My fastest was 26 hours and my slowest was 46 hours, so I've run the whole gamut, as it were. Been there and done that, you know. Fast and slow.
Wow, 26 hours is brilliant. It's like elite level.
Well, that was in the Northumberland one, so it was right up in the Cheviot Hills and everything. It was a lot of ascent.
That's brilliant. That's amazing. So we've got waylaid there from the quickfire questions. Classical art or modern art?
Probably neither, to be honest. I'm not really into art.
No? There's a nice picture of an owl behind you there.
Probably classical then.
Okay, camping or holiday cottage?
Oh, camping, definitely.
Wonderful. Seaside run or mountain run?
Both. I like both, you know, because they're just both different. I like everything.
Mountains at the seaside.
Yeah, that would be good. I mean, I did the Lac y Moray 50 miler back in October, and we had quite a long section along a beach on that, but I actually really enjoyed it, you know. So people said it was boring, but I didn't think it was boring. It was really good.
Awesome. Yeah. So both then. So you must like the Isle of Man Manx Mountain Marathon, because there's that end bit where it's mountains and the sea right next to you.
Yeah, that's lovely. That's really hard because you're going from the cliffs down to sea level and then onto the cliffs again.
One bit, yeah.
I remember it well.
And the final question, would you like a race t-shirt or to plant a tree?
Plant a tree.
Wonderful. You've answered all the questions correctly.
I've got a t-shirts that I never wear in this business.
Do you know what? You should make a race bean bag. My mum's made me this race bean bag. Let me show you here with all my race t-shirts in. So you could get her to make you one of these.
That's cool. Yeah, I see it.
It's got all the, it's a bean bag. So you could get a blanket made. It doesn't have to be a bean bag.
Yeah, great idea.
Yeah, it's a bit lurid, the colours, but you know, it does something
matter,
with them.
Does it?
Yeah,
and also it means that they're out. And
yeah, and you can see them all.
Stuffed in a drawer.
Yeah. Excellent. People do, like, they're people that do it professionally, make things into things like that. So yeah, be a good thing to do. Yeah. Awesome. Oh, well, thank you very much, Anne/Mrs. Yes, Wade.
Yeah.
It's been really wonderful to catch up, and I think there's been some really brilliant advice for anybody of any age, really. I pitched it as a sort of like she's in her early 60s and still running 100 miles, but I think actually it's just great advice for anybody of any age. So I just wanted to say a big thank you for spending so much time with us here today. It's been absolutely great to chat with you, and we shall let you go and pick up the grandkids.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Cool. I'll see you, everyone. Bye.